There's a whole lot of power in my view, free from extremes beyond concepts. There's a whole lot of power right here in the heart of what's been pure from the very start. There's a whole lot of power in my meditation, undistracted and reference free. A whole lot of power is what I find in the great clear light, the great clear light. There's a whole lot of power when I act, because whatever happens, I'm relaxed. There's a whole lot of power flowing easily when actions are natural, relaxed, and free. There's a whole lot of power in the result of pure reality recognizing itself. There's a whole lot of power in the fruit of this great variety being naturally free. There's a whole lot of power in my samaya. I precisely follow the Lama's commands. There's a whole lot of power because nothing is wrong. No vows have been broken, no harm has been done. There's a whole lot of power in my practice, because whatever happens, I adapt to it. There's a whole lot of power, because in the end, all appearances are my friends. I say all appearances are my friends. Whatever questions you have, I'm happy to try to answer. Yeah.
Regarding the arhat, when you say that a Buddha come to Buddha approaches an arhat and tells him, "Hey, buddy, you're not finished yet, right? You have to enter the Mahayana." Okay, that sounds logical. But then, yes, regarding an arhat, yeah, he has not finished the journey. But in order to become an arhat, they see desire as the enemy, so they defeat desire, and in order to become an arhat or to successfully do it, they have to uproot desire from their mind stream. Where does the desire to develop bodhicitta or to attain Buddhahood can come from if they have totally uprooted desire by becoming an arhat?
Well, they haven't totally uprooted it. They think they have, but the reason why they haven't totally uprooted it is that the compassion is part of the Buddha nature. So they can't get rid of that compassion completely. But still, it's explained that it's difficult for them, because they sort of have this transparent body. They don't have the causes anymore to be born in samsara, so they have to go back and find a cause to be reborn in samsara. So it's much better to go on the Mahayana path from the beginning. But what happens is that they somehow tap into this compassion and this desire to be of benefit to beings. That's the part of the true nature of their mind, and then they can enter the Mahayana. Yeah.
I think I understood Rinpoche to say Monday night that purity was the teaching for the 21st century, as instead of emptiness, as had been the case in Tibet. And I was wondering why he said that.
First, we can see that it's really not so much an either-or as it is a question of emphasis, because they're totally interrelated. Because phenomena are of the nature beyond emptiness, beyond conceptual fabrication, then they're perfectly pure. So you can't have one without the other. But a reason why it's so important in the modern age, Rinpoche says, is that there's so much contact between different groups. For example, when you talk about the creator being completely pure. And so there's so much contact between different traditions that it's important to emphasize that all creators are by nature completely pure. That one is not more pure than the other. And that their status is equal in that way. And their status is equal from the perspective of relative reality being free from being just dependently arisen mere appearances.
So is this, in essence, the reason we have so, it is because we have so much group, so many groups, and to keep conflict in between them, if we assume that each is pure, then there's no reason for conflict between the groups that we have?
I think that's one reason. That's one reason. Another reason is that the teachings on perfect purity are the most profound expression of the second turning of the wheel. Because it's not just free from conceptual fabrications, the freedom from conceptual fabrications, but it's that freedom from conceptual fabrications is perfectly pure. And that's really bringing in the meditative experience aspect of it, because if you think about wanting to understand why that's the case, then if you think about being in a dream where you know you're dreaming, then experientially it's much easier to relate to perfect purity. If you know that everything that's appearing to you in the dream is part of this dream and you know it, then you relate in this way where you have this pure relationship with everything and everyone. So it's not just the view of being beyond concept, not just the view of dependent arising, but the view and the experience of perfect purity. And as well, it shows very clearly the connection between the second turning and the third turning, because the third turning talks about the Buddha nature that is pure, that is free of any stain. And not only that, but also the Vajrayana, which is about pure vision and equality. So the equality of everything being pure by nature. And as Rinpoche taught us last night, when you know that a person's three poisons of desire, anger, and stupidity are perfectly pure, then that person must also be perfectly pure. So this is a method to develop pure vision. So what this is showing us is that the ultimate meaning of the second turning and the third turning of the Sutrayana and the pure vision that's the heart of the Vajrayana are the same. Same. And that's the most profound understanding that we can have. And it's because people in this day and age have the capacity, the learning, and the capacity to analyze, which we're taught from a young age in school, and the ability to understand these profound teachings, plus you have all of the technology and everything that's bringing us all these examples of empty forms and how this world is like a big emanation. When you can pick up the phone and call somebody however many thousands of miles away, or you can watch television, or you can send email, and all of these different kinds of things. And it's just getting more and more like that. So all of this comes together to make it the time, Rinpoche believes, to give these most profound teachings. Yeah.
Ari, you seem to use the words phenomena, appearances, emanation. Somehow they all seem synonymous. In what context are they different? Could you just sort of explain that a little bit?
Well, that's a good question. From the Western perspective, I think, like, from the definitions of these words in a Western context, I'm pretty sure a phenomenon means something that appears to you. So from the Buddhist sort of technical perspective, then the word for phenomenon is the same as, it means dharma, right? It's dharma in Sanskrit. And the definition of a dharma is something that holds its own essence. So something that is not a phenomenon is the horns of a rabbit. Right? But everything that appears to us is a phenomenon. And what was the third one? Manifestation?
Emanation.
So you have all of the phenomena of samsara and nirvana. All the phenomena that appear to confused minds, and all of the qualities of enlightenment. So these are all included in phenomena. It's the biggest range. Right? The difference is that not every phenomenon has to appear to you or me directly in order to exist. Right? In a conventional sense. But at least it has to be something that our minds can conceive of and could perceive if we were in the right place and the right time. And if we relate to phenomena in a dualistic way, which is what this is how this text describes phenomena as being what appears to the dualistic mind. And then pure being is the true nature of that, which appears to the enlightened mind. And emanations are a type of phenomena. An emanation is like a conventional description is the emanation of the newscaster that appears on all the different television screens. That's their emanation. With an emanation, you always have a basis or a ground of the emanation, and then the emanations themselves. So for the bodhisattvas and buddhas, then they reside in the pure realm and they send out emanations all over the place, wherever they want. And it's an example of an emanation is an example of appearance emptiness. And the word for emanation in Tibetan is trulpa. And the word that you might be familiar with is truku, you know, which is the nirmanakaya. So this that translates as the emanation body. So the supreme nirmanakaya or the supreme tulku is Shakyamuni Buddha. But then we have from the Tibetan tradition all different kinds of tulkus. So in the Tibetan tradition, there are two kinds of tulkus. One is like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or the Karmapa. They're emanations of Chenrezig. So they have a basis of their emanation, right, of which they are emanations of. And the other kind of tulku is an ordinary individual, an ordinary sentient being who has nevertheless qualities of realization, and so their students recognize them or ask for help in finding their recognition so that they can continue that lineage. Right, so those are different. But in any event, we should know that tukus are, because they're taught by the Buddha as examples of appearance and emptiness, then we should not cling to them as being truly existent. Because this is the very example of appearance and emptiness. So tukus can appear to do all kinds of things. They can appear to teach the Dharma. They can appear to do strange things. They can appear to fight. You know, they can appear to do lots of things. But what we should always remember is that the Buddha taught that these emanations are examples of appearance and emptiness. So you certainly don't want to cling to the example of appearance and emptiness, the paradigm of appearance and emptiness as being truly existent, because that creates more confusion. Other questions?
Is there a difference between complete purity and perfect purity?
Not really. They're basically synonyms, because whatever is perfectly pure is completely pure, and vice versa. So then, if we ask why are they different words, well, they highlight different things. Perfect purity is more talking about down to the essence pure. Perfectly pure down to the very essence of the thing. And complete purity, you could say, is talking about from the perspective of the range of phenomena, everything being completely pure. Or if you're talking about it from the perspective of one phenomenon, then that phenomenon being completely pure of stains. But it means basically the same. Right? It's just, you can find a small difference if you want to in the terms, but their meaning is pretty much the same. Other questions?
I was wondering about the way that we've been reciting the verses from the text in the manner that we have. Is that something that we should continue to do as a practice tool? How do we use that?
Yeah, I think it is. It is a good, because you can see that reciting in that type of voice gives you a nice chance to relax into it, and it kind of pacifies your mind, and you can think of the meaning, or you can meditate. So this is why they recited the Vajrayana ritual practices in this kind of drawn-out melody, because the words are very profound. So you want to have time to sort of savor each word as it comes out. And I don't remember, did Rinpoche teach about the different ways to meditate when you're reciting? Well, basically, you can, if you just focus on the sound that your voice is making when you're reciting, then you're practicing shamatha. Just focus one pointedly on the sound and you rest in that. Or you can look at the sound's absence of any inherent nature, its emptiness. Then you're practicing vipassana, if you rest in that. Or you can reflect on the meaning of what you're reciting. So if the meaning is about the true nature of reality, that's also vipassana. If it's not, then it's called shamatha. When you're reciting from a text, it's called shamatha that has the focus of the wise, of the learned ones. Because it's not just shamatha when you're like focusing on a stick or a candle, but it's shamatha where you're also increasing your knowledge. Because by concentrating one pointedly on the meaning, your knowledge is growing. So you're practicing shamatha at the same time you're learning something. That's why it's called the shamatha of the learned ones. And the last way is to look back at your thoughts, essence, when you're reciting. And you look at basically the nature of your thoughts, luminosity, emptiness, beyond concept. And you just rest within that. That's Mahamudra. So there are all these different ways you can meditate while you recite. And that's why doing it in this kind of melody is good. Sometimes you might want to do it in another way. If you feel like tired, then it might be better to recite in a strong voice, more like a speaking voice. So you can see. It doesn't have to be always one way or the other.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, my question is about the teachings we have. It's of the meditation that we have a session, and are the teachings meant for like post-meditation experience, or are you allowed to go through life doing the awareness techniques, or do you still have to have the discipline of sitting and meditating and then taking this into daily life, or can we just work with it in...
Anytime you want.
Anytime. Because
anytime.
I remember that Rinpoche in Boulder, he always wanted us to have a set discipline of meditation and then take the experience from that into daily life. But I'm finding myself doing or wandering in driving a car or whatever, these things about phenomena, the dreams and things like that, and I'm wondering if that's appropriate or not appropriate.
Yeah, sure.
It's okay.
Milarepa is saying, going, wandering, sleeping, resting, I look at mind. This is virtuous practice without sessions or breaks. And he's saying, when you practice Mahamudra, do short sessions again and again. So in the Mahamudra texts, it says you just want to flash on this true nature of mind. You're talking about maybe also contemplating, and you can do that also anytime too, anytime you feel like you have the time and the space to do it. And you can also just meditate for very short periods. You don't have to sit down on a cushion, and because in the Mahamudra text it says when you start as a beginner, you just do it for the amount of time it takes to lift a glass and drink one swallow, or the amount of time it takes to close and open your eyes, in very short periods of time, again and again. So that you can do anywhere, and we should. One sec.
I'm sorry. I just want to comment. I said, as to what you said, every time that we take a sip in the glass, if we are aware of that, at that very moment becomes like an eternal moment. It comes real and it disappears. And that is when it started growing.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
Over here, I think.
I think, is it? Yeah. I just wanted to ask about the prayer for peace, and how is it that Vajrasattva, the 100-syllable mantra, Vajrasattva mantra, was labeled the purification mantra, like in the Nundro or in this practice? Is it like the purification practice, or
why is Vajrasattva the purification mantra?
Yeah.
Well, it says, I mean, in the Torch of Certainty, I think it gives a good explanation of that. So I would read that introduction to that. But basically, it says there are lots of different ways that you can purify. It doesn't have to be with Vajrasattva, but out of all of those ways the Buddha taught, there's a special connection between Vajrasattva and purification. But it'd be good for you to go back and read that. It explains why. Other questions? Yeah.
Ari, I am a little confused. It's my I don't know if it's my English between the third and fourth practice of meditation. If you can explain us
of the four steps that we went over last
yes,
night.
And how to apply the mind
yeah.
and correctly practice. Thank you.
So the third step is to see that there's no perceiver. And then the fourth step is to rest free of, to rest in what you found. First you find that all objects are mind. Then you find that therefore there's no outer perceived object. Therefore there's no inner perceiving subject. So what's left is non-duality. So that's the fourth step, is you just rest in that. It's not really different than the, it's sort of the result of the steps that have come before it. Sure. And then if you, that's something you can use as a meditative technique. And then again, if you have thoughts of outer objects, then you just start over from the beginning. Just start with step one, again, from the beginning, then you rest, like that. And it's good to recite this verse also, while you're doing that. You can recite it, and then you can rest. You know, then you can recite it again, and you can rest again. That keeps your mind clear, prevents it from falling off into a dull state. If you combine meditation with recitation. Any other questions?
That's kind of what I was going to ask. Is like, would kind of the sequence of practice, maybe you could recite some of the passages and then kind of move into a meditation, and then if you get sleepy or whatever, recite again and then meditate.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And also see if you can begin to start to meditate when you're reciting also. Very good. Is there a question in the back? No? Well, somebody asked me yesterday, they're not here, but if I had any stories to tell of translating or just traveling around with Rinpoche. So one story I thought of was something that just happened when Rinpoche took a break from teaching a couple weeks ago in Florida in between two weekends. And so we went to and stayed in a motel on Hollywood Beach in Florida for a few days. And Rinpoche likes to swim in the ocean. So the waves there were kind of, they weren't very big, but they were big enough that you could do some kind of body surfing. So Rinpoche said the way to swim then, which he taught, was to like just, as the wave is coming right into the shore, to just put your head right in the face of the wave so it goes, so it smacks you right in the... And so, you know, he was kind of trying to, like, do it so you could... So you would dive in. That's how he told me to do it, but the way he was doing it was basically he would just like stand up right when the wave was coming, and then he would kneel down, you know, on his knees and basically like prostrate to the wave as it would just hit him right in the face, you know, and like flip him over. And then he'd be lying there on the beach, he didn't know what to do, right, as all these waves are like going back and forth over him, and then he would laugh and stand up and do it again. So what you find when you do this, I only had the guts to do it this way a few times, but if you like dive into the waves, is that first, I don't know what happens, but I think like when you get older, you get more scared of the water. At least that's my experience. I never used to think of sharks when I was like 10 or 15 years old. But now you see all these things about sharks and whatever. So, and Rinpoche says this too. He says when he was young, he could stay in a charnel ground in Tibet by himself, no problem. But now he says he would be too scared. So he says fear is not something that the occurrence of fear or fearlessness doesn't depend on realization necessarily. It's just what you're thinking about. So when you have this big wave coming at you and you have to dive right into it, then you get this fear in your mind and you get this opportunity to look at that fear. And then you just dive straight into the wave. And when the wave hits you in the face, then you have this non-conceptual experience. And because you have this big experience of smack water right in the face. And it's very good to do that and to meditate, to see if you can look at your mind while you're doing that. Rinpoche really likes to do those kinds of things. So like in Hong Kong, we went to this amusement park called Ocean Park, and they have this ride where they take you, they put you on in this car, and it's one of those things where they take you on this pillow up like 40 or 50 feet, and then it just drops you down, right? So Rinpoche says, then you should see if you can meditate while this is happening, right? So when they drop you down, see if you can look at your mind. Because in the modern age, there's so many chances for sudden events to happen where you need to be able to look at your mind, and you don't have time to think, oh, I need to meditate on this or I need to do that. Right? To train in these techniques of putting yourself in this, you know, situation where you have this fear and then this chance to look at your mind. So what Rinpoche did, I thought I could do this pretty easily, but then they when they take you to the top, then they don't drop you right away. They leave you for some seconds, which seemed like very long. So you're just kind of sitting there, and then Rinpoche says, oh, it's broken, you know, he's like shouting this. But the next time you go to the beach, pardon me?
Was he joking? Or
he was joking. I mean, he was just saying it. It wasn't broken after all. We did drop down. But when the next time you go to the beach, just try this, of like the wave comes and just... You get frightened because you see this wave coming at you, but then you got to run straight at it and you jump into it, and then it hits you in the face, which is this non-conceptuality. And that's another point, is that you can see like the fear of these things is just the anticipation, right? It's the thought of the future that causes the fear, because in the moment of it happening, there's no fear because it's happening. You don't have time. It's just the anticipation of it beforehand. So it helps you to see how it's really just your thoughts of the future that are making this fear, not the actual event itself. Yeah?
Sorry, what is non-conceptual? Does that mean it's an abstract idea that you cannot conceptualize? Is that what you mean by non-conceptual?
It's an experience of your mind that's free from thought. And that kind of experience is actually happening all the time. It's not, we don't create that. Because our sense consciousnesses perceive non-conceptually. Like when you look at me and I look at you, then we just perceive a form. In terms of our eye sense consciousness. Then the next moment, our thoughts come and might label with a name or different qualities or whatever. But in terms of the actual experience of the sense consciousness, it's non-conceptual.
Okay.
And also, it's the same for actually conceptual mind. It's also at its essence non-conceptual. Because when you examine and you try to find this thought, you can't find it. The thought doesn't truly exist. So it does, what's the true nature of the thought is this non-conceptual, non-dual wisdom. And what Ma Mudra and the Vajrayana teach are different methods based on our study and our gaining an understanding of that this true nature of mind is non-conceptual. Then it tries to give us, it uses methods to give us a chance to sort of put our mind in a non-conceptual state so that we can experience what this non-conceptual mind is like. And then you know how to recognize it. You get more familiar with it. Right, so one Ma Mudra meditation that Marpa did was he would go to the top of a mountain and he would just make himself as angry as possible. Right, and then he would look at the mind. Because when you get an intense emotion, then your mind becomes non-conceptual. Right, it's so powerful that you have a chance to look at the mind bare. Right? And you can do the same thing with any emotion, actually. You can do it when you're falling asleep. And you're sort of like moving into this non-conceptual state. Yeah. It's on, I think. There's a red light on at the bottom.
When you experience this very strong emotion or fear or klesha, whatever kind of activity, and you're looking at it, and you see that it doesn't have any essence, but there's still something more than just the emptiness of it, which has something to do with relating it to the Buddha energies, the Buddha wisdom. What does it mean to actually experience the wisdom of that other than the emptiness of it?
Well, the experiencing the wisdom is a conventional description after the of that event. But while you're having that experience, you're not thinking wisdom or not. Right? Or if you do get a thought of that, then also you want to look at the essence of that. Because from the experience's perspective, it doesn't have any label. Right? That's why it's really beyond conceptual fabrications. So, you're right, it's not just emptiness. But when you examine, and you don't find anything, and then you rest, then your experience is one of luminosity and clarity and openness. But the moment that we label those things, we cling to those things, then we're not in that experience anymore. Then we have to look again. So, but sometimes I think what happens is, like you say, you can sort of investigate, but it's still... you find it's empty, but then it still seems like there's something left over. And then what you want to do is look at that thought of there being something left over. And this is what Ma Mudra teaches, is that even at the end of the analysis, you look at the analyzer. Right? You look at the mind, and then the last step is to look at the one who's looking. And then you rest.
But there seems to be some kind of distinction between, at least when we're talking about the Buddha families, as to the quality of, say, anger versus desire. There's some kind of difference rather than kind of an equal.
Yeah.
You know?
It seems to us like that at this stage. Like anger is this very powerful emotion, so that's there's like this sort of emphasis of the clarity aspect. And so that's why it's called mirror-like wisdom, because the mirror is very clear. Whereas desire is taught to be of the nature of bliss emptiness, because when you rest in the true nature of the passion, then it's this very blissful experience. But from the perspective of the true nature of mind, there's no difference. And Milarepa sings about this very clearly when he says in the song called The Three Nails of Meditation, to describe the nails of meditation, the three, all thoughts in being Dharmakaya are free. So all thoughts are of the nature of Dharmakaya. But then what is Dharmakaya? He sings in the next line, awareness is luminous, in its depths is bliss. So you have these three qualities of awareness, or rigpa, luminosity, salwa, and bliss, deva. And they're all the same. Right? They're all present in the Dharmakaya. They're undifferentiable. Awareness is luminosity, is bliss, is awareness, is emptiness. There really is no difference. They're highlighted as different from the perspective of the explanation of the five wisdoms as just being different aspects. Right? Like, so you can identify the clarity aspect of the mind. So what highlights the clarity aspect the most? Anger. Now that's why, like, anger's perfect purity. If you ever need, like, to wake up, you're tired, then make yourself angry and recite the anger's perfect purity verses. You'll wake up really fast. So that's what that highlights. And the bliss seems to be more highlighted by the passion, the desire aspect. So, but these are just giving us sort of entryways to what in essence is undifferentiable.
Thanks. One other question, if I could ask. Can you tell us a little bit about Maitreya, since this text is Maitreya's distinguishing phenomenon of pure being, and in relation to his being a future Buddha, particularly?
There are different Maitreyas. One is the Maitreya who is the Bodhisattva. One is the Maitreya who is the Buddha. One is Maitreya who is a guru, an ordinary sentient being who is a guru. So, and they're all actually the same. They're emanations of the same. So the classic Mahayana explanation is that Maitreya is the one whom the Buddha empowered when the Buddha left the pure realm to come down and demonstrate enlightenment, then he left Maitreya in charge. And Maitreya will be the next one to demonstrate enlightenment. But what we know about the Buddha from the Mahayana perspective is that when the Buddha did that, he had already attained enlightenment eons ago. So he was just demonstrating it. So Maitreya is also just demonstrating it too. Maitreya has already attained enlightenment. He's just manifesting to us as this 10th Bhumi Bodhisattva. And then he taught these texts to a Sangha. Do people know the story of how he taught these texts to a Sangha? So, a Sangha's... The story actually starts with Asanga's mother. Asanga's mother was a Buddhist nun. Her name was Prakasha Shila. And she lived at a time when the Buddha's teachings were under attack. They were in danger of disappearing. Because at that time in India, the tradition was that Well, the tradition was for masters of different philosophical traditions to debate. And whoever lost the debate would, along with all of their followers, adopt the tradition of the winner. as testimony to the honesty of the debate. So several times in Indian history, there appeared brilliant non-Buddhist teachers who would take these very profound teachings, like the ones from this text about non-duality and luminosity, and make them seamless with their own. And they were better at defending these teachings than their Buddhist counterparts. So when that happened, then all the Buddhists would have to adopt the other tradition. So this was happening at the time of Prakashashila. And she thought to herself, well, you know, I, at this time, because I'm in a woman's body, I'm not allowed to participate in these debates. So I can't do anything myself. But I can give birth to sons who can become great masters and defenders of the Dharma. And so, with a member of the Kshatriya, or the king's caste in India, the noble caste, she gave birth to a Sangha. And then, with a Brahmin man, she gave birth to Vasubandhu. And when they grew up, when they got old enough, then they asked their mother, what is our father's occupation? Because that was a tradition in India, to follow the work of the father. And she said, I didn't give birth to you to follow your father's occupation. I gave birth to you and raised you so you could study the Dharma and defend it and become great teachers. And so they were so impressed by that, that immediately they wanted to do what their mother had wished for them. And so Vasubandhu went to study with a Kashmiri temple, and a Sangha went to a mountain called Kukutapada to practice the deity practice of Maitreya, to meditate on Maitreya in the hopes of meeting him face to face and receiving his teachings. Well, he practiced for 6 years first in a cave, nonstop, and nothing happened. Not only did he not meet Maitreya, but he had no signs of progress. He didn't even have a good dream in 6 years. So he thought, well, that's it. I'm not good at this, so I give up. So he went down the mountain, and on his way on the road, he met a man who was holding an iron bar about this big, and he was rubbing it with a cotton cloth. And he was very intrigued by that. So he asked the man, what are you doing? So the man said, well, I need a needle. And Asanga was astounded. He thought, this guy is going to be here for 100 years. He might not even live to get his needle. And he was so impressed with how much diligence worldly people can put into totally meaningless activity. And he thought, well, if this person can have so much diligence as this, then I can have more diligence in my practice. So he turned around, he went back up the mountain, and he went and sat down in his cave again. This time he sat down for 3 years, and again, nothing happened, zero. Not even a good dream again. So he thought, okay, I can't do this, I give up. And this time he walked down the mountain, and on his way on the road he met a man. And the man had this bucket of water, and he was in the house. He says, so I have to knock this boulder down a little bit, and then in the afternoon I'll get some nice sunshine. Right? So these were both, it's taught, emanations of Maitreya. And then, so Sangha had the same thought as before. He thought to himself, you know, this person can be so diligent in such a stupid thing. I can have more diligence in my Dharma practice. So he went back up the mountain, and he sat down again for another 3 years, and again, nothing happened. So now he thought, I quit, I give up, I don't care who I meet, I'm done. I'm not coming back. And he went down the road, and this time, in the middle of the road, he met a dog, a very angry dog, who was trying to bite him. But the dog couldn't get to a sangha to bite him because the whole back of the dog was just one totally open sore, you know, festering wound that was rotting and that was crawling with maggots. And a sangha was so overwhelmed by compassion for this dog that he took his knife and he cut out of his thigh a piece of meat and he put it in front of the dog so the dog could have something to eat. And then he thought to himself, but, you know, I have to help clean this dog's wound. So he thought he would take the maggots from the dog's wound and put them in his own wound. But then he thought, well, if I do that with my fingers, I'll crush these maggots because these maggots are so soft. And he didn't want to do that. So he thought, the only way that I can do this is with my tongue. But every time he, you know, he tried to bend down, it smelled so bad and it was so repulsive that he couldn't do it. So he thought, the only way I can do this is just to close my eyes and go for it. You know, so he shut his eyes really close and he went. And he kept bending down. And he was getting lower and lower. And it smelled so bad. But eventually he kept bending down and he never would touch the dog. And eventually, with his tongue, he tasted the dust of the road. And he didn't know what happened, so he opened his eyes, and there was no dog. And he's looking down at the ground, and then he starts to hear this heavenly music. And he looks up, and there in a halo of light is Maitreya. So he's looking up at Maitreya, and the music going, ooh, doo, doo. And he looks up and he says, the first thing he says is, you are so cruel. I've been practicing you for 12 years and you never showed your face. You're so mean to me. And Maitreya looked down at him from the rainbow light and the music and he said,
that's not true. I have been with you the whole time. But you did not see me. Your 12 years of practice purified your obscurations a little bit. And so you were able to see me as the dog. But then your great compassion purified all of your obscurations completely and you were able to see me face to face as I has always been with you.
And a sangha must have still looked like he didn't believe that, because then Maitreya said,
if you don't believe me, then put me on your shoulder and carry me through town and ask the people who they see.
So he did. He took Maitreya on his right shoulder and he carried him into the market and he went up to everybody and he said, who do I got on my shoulder? And all the people who he asked went, they didn't see anybody. Until finally, he met an old woman who had also purified her obscurations a little bit. And she said, Sonny, why are you carrying around that dead dog? And then Maitreya took a sangha to the Tushita heaven and taught him the five texts of Maitreya. And then when a sangha came back, he spread these texts in the human realm. And the importance of this story is that it teaches us the importance and the power of great compassion. Because a sangha practiced for 12 years, straight meditation, for his own benefit. And that was not nearly as powerful as one instant of great compassion that he had for the dog, which totally wiped out his obscuration. So whatever we do, as Mahayana practitioners, motivated by as much compassion as possible is that much more powerful. Which brings us to the end of our hour. May we live long and be free of illness, enjoy freedom, great resources, and happiness. Next life may we meet in the pure realm. May we always practice Dharma and benefit beings.